Investigators analyzing the bloody evidence left at the crime scene found an entirely new suspect. His name, Rudy Gadet, a known petty criminal from the Ivory Coast who fled to Germany shortly after the murder.
Jim Clemente, former New York City prosecutor, retired FBI profiler, and writer, producer on Criminal Minds, as well as co-creator and producer on CBS's The Case of, JonBenet Ramsey. Today with me is...
Laura Richards. I'm a victim advocate and activist, and I'm also director and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service, and also a co-creator and producer on CBS's The Case of JonBenet Ramsey.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for Criminal Minds and Criminal Minds Beyond Borders. And I have a real interest in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes.
So we've been talking in this series about the murder of Meredith Kircher. And we left off last week talking about the motives. What was actually the basis or the motive of this crime, and was there a time when it changed? So, Laura, why don't you weigh in on what you think that was, the motive that created this?
I think it's a, you know, as you know, Jim, it's a really important thing for anyone to understand, particularly if they're working this type of case. And, you know, as I previously said on our last pod, you know, I've done quite a lot of research since, and I remember the case unfolding. And of course, what you see in the media and what the reality is are two very different things. But I always say you might have the what, the where, the when. You might have the why, not always. You certainly don't get the who. And, you know, one of the biggest challenges in a crime like this is the why. You know, what is motivating it? And I think that having looked at all of the, as much of the evidence as I have been able to see, and the crime scene video and some of the photos and reading a lot of the material, you know, it certainly strikes me that the primary motive of this particular crime and case is burglary. And I know there's a lot that has been said about whether this burglary was a bona fide burglary or whether it was staged. But I think from all things considered and from seeing some of the pictures and understanding the window and understanding the individuals involved, it certainly sounds like it was a burglary that then evolved into something else.
Yeah, I agree. And if we just talk about the burglary and what that means, were it staged, people who stage crimes to look like something else are people who have a connection to that location typically, or to the person that was killed, a known connection, that they were known to have been with that person at that time, so they want to change the nature of what happened into something that was not true. So why would somebody, we know that Rudy Gadet was in that house by his own admissions, by the fact that he left his DNA all over the crime scene, in quantity, not trace DNA, in quantity. Yeah.
Quantity in multiple locations.
Yes, in multiple locations, as well as his finger and palm prints and his shoe prints in multiple locations. So for all those reasons, his own admissions, all the DNA and all the fingerprint and shoe prints in blood, in the victim's blood, all over that house and that room, we know that he was there.
But there's a point before that, isn't there? I think just when I sort of roll my memory back to how this case was covered in the media, and we did talk about that quite a lot, that the sexual element of this case was what was really prevalent. And, you know, therefore, most people think that this was very much a sexually motivated type crime. And admittedly, I thought, you know, that this was probably a sexually motivated and possibly targeted. You know, was there stalking, for example? Was Meredith picked off at another time? You know, and you have to test all of these hypotheses to understand, you know, what was possible, what was probable, given all the evidence. And, you know, and I think that's another key point, that as we know from offenders who break into home addresses, that majority of burglars want to go in and they don't want anyone present. They want to be in right. and get out as quickly as possible with the things that they're taking, normally kind of quick to carry items. And in this particular case, you know, I kind of believe that, or I don't kind of, I do believe that it started out as a burglary. And I believe that there was a bathroom or time break. Spent in the bathroom break, and he got caught short. And that's when things start to become dynamic, and realizing that there's no way to get out. If you flush the toilet, then it alerts whoever has just come back. But believing that no one would come back because it was still relatively early, and being caught short, that then he has to try and get out of the address. And I think that he understood the door was locked and he couldn't get out as silently as he wanted to. And therefore, he only has a number of options at his disposal. And I think when he challenges Meredith and he's trying to get out, I think then things evolve again. And opportunistically, he takes, you know, the opportunity around the sexual assault. But I don't think that that was the primary motive in terms right. of going to that address and targeting her specifically.
Right. I was what just talking think? About, well, I was talking about the staging still. Why would someone who has been arrested for burglary stage a scene to look like a burglary when it would only increase the number of fingers pointing at him? Perugia is not a big city. It doesn't have a tremendous amount of crime. And to stage it, if he were the one that staged it, then why would he stage it to be something that he's already known to have done?
Yeah, that doesn't make sense.
Right. And then look at the other two people who are accused of potentially staging it, and that's Amanda Knox and Raffaele Sollecito. How would they know? Because it wasn't public knowledge. It was known to the police and it was known to Rudy Guede that he had thrown a rock through a second story window and a gained entry through the second story window in another location. I think it was the home of the attorney where he stole laptops, which were in his possession when he was arrested. But how would Raffaele and Amanda know of this MO aspect in order to stage it to look like he did it? I mean, it's just fantastical. Anyway, that's just the basic, from a behavioral perspective, why that the staging would have been a ridiculous theory to come up with. But then if you look at the actual physical evidence, many people believe that the staging was a fact because there were clothes strewn on the bed and the floor, and that there was glass on top of those clothes. And that's because they assume, one, that these pictures were an accurate representation of how the crime scene was left at the time that the offender left it, and that there was no additional activity after the rock came through that window. The fact is, multiple people went in there, and including Philomena, who went in and after the police arrived at the scene, took her laptop computer out of that room. So we don't know, one, how she left the room. Did she leave in a rush, throwing things around, leaving things on the bed or so forth? Did a bunch of the glass fall on the bed? And then when Rudy Guede came in the window, he may have gone onto the bed and knocked things onto the floor and knocked glass on top of it that was on the bed. I mean, there's so many different
things. There's so many variables.
Crime scenes are dynamic. They don't just happen in a vacuum and then stay put. These pictures that everybody looks at were taken many hours after the crime occurred, many hours. And so a lot of things could have happened in between, including continuous activity by the person who came through that window. So it just their theories about the fact that this had to be staged are based on their lack of knowledge of crime scene reconstruction, lack of knowledge of crimes themselves.
Right, but they were fairly clear in their determination, the police, when they said that this was a crime that was staged.
And I think
their theory, yes, and that's become kind of you know, in the zeitgeist, that people just take that verbatim.
But I think when
we take it as fact, and I think that's why it's important that we strip it back. That even if we take it away from, you know, the who are the individuals, and just look at the behaviour alone, would it make sense for someone to do this? Would it make sense for someone to stage it? Well, as you quite rightly said, no, it wouldn't. particularly if you think about then the person involved. But the other point is to stage, as we know, it takes time. Mm-hmm. And it means that you're putting yourself more at risk by spending time at that address. And I believe from looking at the crime scene photos and the things that are available, the material that's available, this was someone who afterwards didn't spend time at the address because there wasn't a huge amount that was done their post. This was somebody who was probably quite panicked and trying to get out and create distance between them and this particular crime scene. That's probably much more likely than someone spending time there and risking another member of the house or somebody else coming to the address at that time.
Well, especially if the person, if there was no one else that knew that this person was in the house, why would you add time and increase the risk of getting caught if no one else on the planet, other than you and the dead person, knew that you were there? It just makes no sense.
Plus, if you're staging, if you're going to the trouble to stage it, why not then take the laptop and actually steal things if you're going to stage a robbery? Wouldn't you want to steal more and look like it had all been ransacked?
And this wasn't, of course, a burglary, and there is a difference between a robbery and a burglary. But the two phones we discussed before, didn't we? Meredith's phones went.
$300 was missing.
$300, some
and
keys.
Her keys.
Right.
Yeah, so some things were taken, but I think the laptop being set down in Philomena's room, I do think that could well have been certain things being placed, you know, getting ready to take
right,
them.
But then he went to the bathroom and got surprised, and he forgot about it in there. But he may have trashed the room in there. I can give you a perfect example, okay? Let's say he came in and the room was pristine. There was clothes, a bag of clothes, whatever. There was glass on the bed. There was, a laptop on the desk and other things. Well, he could come in, find the laptop, say, okay, this is something I want to remember. I'll place it right in the middle of the room so I don't forget it. And then he goes and he looks at that bag of clothes and he dumps it out. And he sees, well, there's nothing I can really use here. He leaves it strewn on the bed and on the floor. And then he wants to sit down on the bed. So he sweeps his hand across the glass that's on the bed in one area and spreads the glass on top of clothes that's on the bed and on clothes that's on a floor. And then says, you know what? I have to go to the bathroom. He goes down the hall to the bathroom. He gets surprised while he's in there, never gets to finish his job, the burglary that he was going to do there, but ends up going through the purse that Meredith put on her bed. And he did this, obviously, after she had been incapacitated and was either dead or dying.
Because of the bloody palm print.
I think, I'm not sure if the palm print was on the purse or on the pillow. I know part of his handprint was on the pillow, there was at least fingerprints on the purse. But the purse was left on the bed after the duvet was taken off the bed and put over her body. That's, again, that tells you something about timing. Then he leaves the house. He had to have had the keys in order to leave the house. And he didn't lock the door when he left. In fact, he left it open. But he locked her room door. And I believe that was looking at the pictures, it was a door that you can turn the knob on the inside of the bedroom door and close it, and it would be locked from the inside.
Oh, so you didn't need a key to lock it.
No.
Okay.
And interestingly, there was none of his DNA or forensics found on the outside of her bedroom door. But I think, you know, if we go back to staging, you know, when the rest of the scene is so chaotic, it wouldn't make sense to stage those other things. And I think when we talk about, you know, which parts, well, what's targeted, I think the burglary is very much targeted and much more organized. And then all the other things were just dynamic and chaotic. And
right.
We see a very disorganized crime scene. By his own admission, Guede, and we'll talk about him specifically, but in his own admission, he puts himself in the house. He gives an account. But he talks about, towels being taken back and forth, trying to staunch the bleeding. So we know that things were changed in terms of, you know, he's giving an account as to why his forensics are there. But we talked in our last pod about him cleaning himself up. But we did make the point that wasn't about cleaning the crime scene up per se.
No, I mean, he did say that he got towels. And in his interview, he goes into detail about that. But the fact is that it's very clear that there was some attempt to wipe up some of the blood, but that also may have been to clean himself because he knew he would have to get out of there. And we know that since then, that when he does go to Germany, he throws his pants away, throws a knife away. He does some kind of sort of panicked cleanup at the scene, but not a good enough job that he can just sort of walk away nonchalantly. But the fact is that in the behavioral analysis unit at the FBI, when we were putting together the behavioral analysis manual, and I was the chair of that team that was working on putting that manual together, one of the concepts that we came to was the fact of mixed organization levels. Some people think, well, an offender, if they're smart and they think and they're experienced in a particular crime, that they're always going to be organized then. Well, that's not true because, again, crimes and crime scenes are dynamic.
And victims. You can never control, you know, or you can never predict. Or
what the circumstances are.
Exactly, how right. Someone reacts.
So we call it mixed organization level crimes. And we see, as you pointed out, Laura, indications of both planning and sophistication in terms of burglary, but no planning and no sophistication in terms of forensics or the ability to control the victim at all without causing that person's death, and in a way that would leave not only his physical evidence there, but plenty of physical evidence of the victim all over the place. So that's a disorganized aspect to this crime. So the fact that we have both organized and disorganized behavior does tell us something behaviorally, and that is you go from somebody who thought A was going to happen but ended up getting involved in B, which he was not prepared for.
Right, and certainly couldn't control, and it became a very dynamic thing that offenders, it's decision-making, you know, it happens, you know, on the hoof a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. And we sit there and we try and rationalize it in the cold light of day, but that's not how the interaction takes place or is shaped. And I think we're mentioning sort of motive, because the media and, you know, via the prosecution, the police, etc., talked about, you know, this was a sex game gone wrong, and very much put into the public zeitgeist that this was a sex crime and it was very much targeted. You know, I think from looking at the crime scene and understanding what happened, well, I saw no sign of any ritualistic behavior and certainly no sign of, you know, sex game paraphernalia.
No, in the crime scene, you don't see any blood spatter shadowing, so there's no indication that there were multiple offenders there. You see defensive wounds on the victim, and there were defensive wounds on Meredith Kircher, at least 3 cuts on her hand, 2 of them from a sharp blade, knife-type wounds, and one of them from a sharp, pointy-type wound that was more of a tear. On her hands. Those are defensive wounds.
So she was fighting back, yes. And this was in the autopsy report.
Yes, and also her elbows were bruised and her leg or thigh was bruised. There's a lot of indications that she was fighting back. However, it's also a fact we know the offender had a knife. And many times, human beings can be controlled with a knife. Why is that? They're actually more easily controlled with a knife than they are with a gun. Mm-hmm. And why is that? Because most people haven't been shot before. They haven't experienced that before. So it's an unknown to them, but almost everybody has been cut, and they know the feeling of it. They know how easily a knife can cut through their fingers. They know how much damage it can be done. It's something they have a visceral memory of because they've just lived their lives. Most people haven't been shot, and so they act differently. They'll run away from a gun, but a knife can control people.
Right. And the point of the injuries, I mean, you describing them, and certainly, you know, we talked about over 40 of them, is that if this were multiple individuals, multiple perpetrators working in concert with each other, she would have been overpowered far
immediately.
More.
Yeah, immediately.
Effectively.
Yes. If her arms were pinned and her legs were pinned, she would have been taken advantage of very easily. There wouldn't have been, instead of 3 slices on her neck, there would have been 1 slice on her neck. Instead of multiple stab wounds into her neck, there would have been 1. There's no reason to keep doing it if you've already inflicted a fatal blow. If there's one person holding that person, stabbing that person, trying to control that person, you're going to see defensive wounds unless there's a blitz attack. For example, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of cases where blitz attack happens, this is where somebody surprises with overwhelming force the victim. and that victim is not able to respond. They're knocked out, they're incapacitated, or they're controlled immediately. And that's it. They can't fight back. They're then put in restraints or something of that nature. And
once incapacitated, then the perpetrator or perpetrators can then do whatever they choose to. But that's not what was happening in this case.
No, absolutely not. This person did not respond the way the offender predicted they would or anticipated they would. And therefore, there was a struggle. There was a fight. There were defensive wounds. It was a bloody mess, something that he did not intend to happen, put forensic evidence of the victim all over him, left his forensic evidence all over the scene. And, for example, the cut on his hand, which he is trying to say happened when some guy who he surprised in Meredith's room turned around and slashed at him with what he said was a scalpel. He says that happened to him. Well, we know from experience that when offenders stab somebody with a knife that doesn't have a big hilt, that sometimes the blade hits something in the person's body and then slides the knife blade back up in the person's hand and cuts that person's fingers. That is more likely what happened. It's consistent with this crime scene and with this crime, and that's what I believe happened. It makes sense.
It sounds highly more probable. And one of the other injuries that I saw that was reported on was trauma to her scalp, where her hair was being held. And of course, how a struggle starts with maybe two people standing, one behind the other, and then one overpowering and pushing someone to the ground could mean an account for, you know, holding someone by the hair, the reason why you have different injury points around the neck. So where it could start standing up, you know, and this is something that numerous people have sort of debated on our Twitter feed, you know, how do you account for different injuries around her neck or, you know, how the struggle ensues? But of course, it could start with them standing up and could end with her down on the ground. And we know that she was because of the bruising around her face as well.
He's a tall, powerful, athletic man, and she is a young lady who didn't have, even though she had some karate training, even though she was athletic, she didn't have the strength to fight him. I would venture to say that the vast majority of crimes like this occur one offender on one victim. It's extremely rare to have multiple offenders get together and slice somebody's throat and sexually assault them.
In concert with each other in this way.
It's a fantasy, and it is, yes, has it happened? Yes, but when it does happen, there's indicators of those.
Can you talk about
yeah,
what,
look
what
at the
blood splatter,
Tate Bianca shatter murders. Okay. Look at them. Okay, that's a perfect example. And it's a wild crime scene. There's all sorts of different activities going on, and there's indicators of multiple people there. There is none of that in this case. None. Not a single piece of evidence of multiple offenders. And that's, in fact, what the Supreme Court held in the final decision in this case.
And in that actual room in particular, because people still keep harking back to the fact that their DNA, etc., Raffaele's and Amanda's, was outside of that room, which, of course, it would be because they were there and Amanda was living there. So it makes perfect sense for that to be the case. But for it to be absent in the crime scene itself, how would you be able to clean that up to such a degree?
Yeah, the prosecution claimed that Raffaele and Amanda went in and cleaned out all of their DNA and left only Rudy Guede's.
Yeah, they'd somehow know how to do that.
Well, it's not how to do that. It's that, could it be done?
Well, that's
no,
what
it
I
can't
mean.
Be
yeah,
done.
That's what I mean.
It's, you're talking about microscopic DNA. You're talking about like a couple of cells, something that you would never, ever be able to see with your own eye. And certainly they didn't run around with scientific equipment to do that. It's just not possible. It is a fanciful theory that the prosecution came up with because right at the start, they wanted to go after Amanda and Raffaele.
Can I ask you what blood spatter shadowing is? Mm-hmm.
Blood spatter shadowing is when someone either hits an artery or has multiple strikes or stabs at a person into a bloody injury, and then blood is either sprayed out because of arterial spurting or because of the motion of the weapon when it comes out of the person and goes back in, swinging back and forth. if someone is present in that crime scene and they're in the direct path of that blood spray, you will see on either side of that person, or even in the depending on the size of the spray, even in the shape of another person, a shadow on the wall. You'll see blood spattered around the shape of the person, and you will see a blank space where there's somebody was standing. And that person leaves the crime scene with the spatter on their own body, and that's why you see a shadow on the wall or the floor or the duvet or the armoire. And we saw none of that in this case. And that means that it appears at some point that Rudy got behind Meredith Kircher and stabbed her in an upward motion into her neck and throat, and then across, held the knife a couple of times on her throat, which left parallel, very shallow scrapes on her neck, and then a third time pulled the knife across her neck and caused that 3 or 4 inch gaping wound. And so he would have been behind, not in the way of the direction of the spurt, but actually protected by her own body from the spurt. But she would have then gone down. And I think I misspoke in one of the earlier podcasts about the handprint on the wall. I believe that Gede made a statement that he actually was trying to write what she was saying on the wall. That. So that might have been his handprint on the wall rather than Meredith's. But either way, it's consistent with the scene having started towards the head of her bed, perhaps even sitting on that, pulling her back towards the bed because there was some direct drips straight down from a wound, a bleeding wound, onto the slats of the bed and then through the slats onto the floor. And that those stains indicate an earlier stage of the crime rather than a later stage, which we saw the massive smearing and struggling and then the aspirated blood.
Can you talk about what would be ritualistic artifacts in the room if there was something going on?
Yeah, well, you would expect to see things like candles or Bibles or, you know, certain underwear or restraints or things that, you know, that point to the fact that there's something more happening in terms of sort of the fantasy base and engagement.
Yeah,
but in fact,
writing
there was,
on the walls.
Yeah, and there was and having seen some of those crime scenes, this was very, very different and it was absent. There were no signs of that at all, and it was a chaotic crime scene.
Yeah, and that happened in the Tate-Lobianco murders too, where they did write pig on the wall or something like that.
You would see signs. I mean, it can be different, you know, it varies depending on what the, you know, the psychology of the individual is. But, you know, this doesn't look like a sex game gone wrong when you don't see any paraphernalia either to that tune. And just the way that her body was left, you know, in terms of her being half naked and her bra being cut off and her top being pushed up. I mean, it looks much more like, you know, what I would say, just a lone offender, a lone perpetrator. And like I said before, a sexually motivated crime. But, you know, I do think the sexual assault side was opportunistic in this case. And, you know, he has taken the opportunity and has put her, I think she was on the floor, and where things may have started of standing to sitting to her being on the floor, that he takes the opportunity and puts a pillow underneath her. And, you know, we know that there is certainly skin cells from his finger, which he admits that happened. He says that it was consensual. And we will talk about his account, Guede's account specifically. So that points to digital penetration at the very least. And that's all you can say scientifically, at the very least. We know there was a semen stain, but of course that wasn't tested.
Right. But, all we know is they're skin cells. We don't know where they came from, whether it's from his finger or his penis or some other part of his body. But we know there's skin cells inside of her.
They are epithelial cells.
Right.
And
those are skin cells.
He also said, well, I did read somewhere actually that they said they were from it was from his fingers. And he then said on interview 2 that, yes, it was digital penetration, but it was consensual.
He said it was consensual. It could be from his finger, but it could also be from his penis. I don't believe you can tell the difference between a skin cell on your finger and a skin cell on your penis. They're still skin cells. They're not
distinguishable that way.
Membrane type cells. I'm trying to. But But the point is that there is semen on that pillow, and the prosecution deliberately did not test it. And I know we talked about it before, but it's just unconscionable. Right. Unconscionable in this kind of crime.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the point I'm trying to make is we can't talk in absolutes because we just don't know.
Right.
And that's really, you know, in terms of behaviour and science, that part we genuinely don't know. We know what was found in her vaginal swabs. We don't know where it came from, but he does say in his account where it came from. And I'm sure I read somewhere else, and I'll try and find it.
Okay.
But my, you know, I was wondering whether the sexual side, when it starts, that it's not a completed act anyway. And of course, we don't know because the semen was never tested. So whether he then, you know, for whatever reason, takes a different tack and panics and then wants to get out of the address, again, we don't know. And, you know, this is one of the biggest problems when a crime scene isn't processed in the right way,
but we
start to end.
Right. We should also keep in mind, though, that he wants us to believe, based on his statements, that the sexual act was not completed. But the fact is that a sexual assault was absolutely completed. We know that for a fact. And sex is not the same thing for all people. Just because it's not, you know, intercourse does not mean that it's not a sexual assault. There is no indication of any consensual nature to this. She didn't put down her jacket and her keys in the living room right next to his jacket and, you know, or take off their shoes and leave them there and all that kind of stuff. That would look like, you know, that they were engaging in sexual activity like he wants to say they were, and then moved into the bedroom. I mean,
well, I think we should take his account apart piece by piece, because this is basically where it's going, isn't it? Of, you know, matching his account to what was found at the crime scene. And there are very clear inconsistencies at best there.
Yeah, but even her friends never testified that she was meeting somebody or that she'd ever met him. And,
well, you know, I mean, apparently she did meet him. She may have met him down, I mean, the time when he was staying over at the...
Right, other than in passing.
Yes, I mean, the guy's house downstairs. He was there. He stayed over one night. Amanda came down. Meredith apparently came down. They may have been at the same bar at the same time, but there's no indications that they were together. And we'll talk when we get to his statement about that, about the indicators of deception when he's talking about it. Just talking about the sexual assault, I mean, it's the fact that Guede so adamantly says that he did not have sex with her. He did not have intercourse with her. He did not rape her. That makes me believe that he did. I mean, why is he so hell-bent on proving that he didn't do that? He knows he's going to jail for this. And rapists usually have a rough time in prison because the other guys that are in there have sisters and girlfriends and wives, and they don't want them raped, so that they don't usually treat rapists very well in prison. So it could be that. But it could also be that he knows he did this, and he knows it's a reprehensible crime, and he wants to paint himself as such a nice guy, a wonderful person.
Yep, he certainly does do that in his interview, which we should probably...
We'll get to.
Yeah, we will get to. And I think one of the interesting things that I would really like to know is that if he did have girlfriends, which he said that he did, is what they would say about him.
Hmm.
Because again, you know, this kind of power and control dynamic, which I think was happening when he was in, not just in the house, but when he was interacting with Meredith. And if he did get sexually aroused and then he starts, you know, to sexually assault her, and it's opportunistic. Yes, it could have been digital. Yes, it could have been penile. But he did, you know, he was aroused one way or the other. And whether it was a completed sexual assault or not, it's very difficult to say because of that semen stain not having been analysed. But I think that certainly the way that he, his account and how he conducts himself and how he portrays events, there are some, you can drive a truck through a lot of the things that he says, but he does present incredibly well.
Right.
And so those who don't know the case, it all sounds highly plausible.
Right. Well, something you just said struck a chord with me also, that this is at night, the day after, it's November 1st, right? right after Halloween, and he does have a habit of going out to bars and clubs and the disco and so forth. It's possible that he was drinking or partaking of drugs, because that lowers inhibition. And you said it's a crime of opportunity. People's inhibitions are lowered when they have when they're under the influence of a substance like that. And so he can make decisions that he wouldn't normally make, bad decisions, decisions that ended up, in this case, in the murder of Meredith Kircher. And I think that's probably, that's another indicator, both the time and the fact that he made not very good decisions about what to do next. And had he not been impulsive, had he actually thought through, he probably wouldn't have attacked her and killed her. But he did. And so that behavior tells us that his impulses were very high. His impulse control was very low. So that's an indicator he could have been under the influence of alcohol or drugs at the time.
I think that's a good point. And, you know, again, you know, with baseline of behavior, it could be that he's just a poor decision maker. But exactly as you said, Jim C., there could be alcohol and or drugs involved too, which clouds judgment, changes the dynamic. And one thing that makes sense at that time would not make sense in, right, in the rational light of day. And I think that's an interesting point, because he does talk about drugs and alcohol in his interview. So
it's not him, right? Again, it's one of the things that he adamantly denies. It's all about image, right? But we'll get to that in a little bit.
We will. And I mean, the last point just around the crime scene, and, you know, it was visible in the crime scene video, was just about the duvet that had been it looked like it had been thrown over her rather than she had been, you know, covered from head to toe. Her face was showing, and I believe it was her left foot that was sticking out as well.
Talking about the duvet, what it reminded me of, this is just from my gut, you know, it reminds me almost like a childlike behavior, like when a child messes something up or breaks something and they just like throw their blanket over it, because if I can't see it, it didn't happen. Or when you're trying to hide and you just put your blanket, like, I'm not here because you can't see me. That's in my gut. That's what I thought when I saw that.
What did you make of that, Jim?
Well, some people have said that indicates that the offender cared for the victim. I think it's the exact opposite. This wasn't a caring, loving, nurturing, wrapping the victim in a blanket. This was carelessly tossed over her so that he didn't have to look at her. He had made a mess, not only of this scene physically, but of his life at this point. I think it's something he didn't want to face. I think it's something that he, after he was done, I believe that he probably did ejaculate, and after that, male offenders, after they ejaculate, the next 10 minutes, they really take a deep dive into depression, that they really feel, those are the times when they really feel the most weight of what they had just done. It can really hit them, and typically they panic and try to get the hell out of there. But he had come to this place, and I think this is another indicator of the ultimate initial motive of this was the crime of burglary, because he did then, after he placed the duvet over the victim, the dead or very close to dying Meredith Kircher, he then took her purse and went through it, took money, credit cards, phones, and her keys, and left the apartment. And I think that tells you what kind of person Rudy Gaye is. The fact that after he had sexually assaulted and murdered Meredith Kircher, he then burglarized her house and committed it was actually a simple crime that he had intended to. He just made sure that he actually carried it out. Not to the point where he remembered the laptop. I think he was too frazzled after the crime to think of that. But he wasn't too frazzled to get money and credit cards and phones. His phone had been taken, another thing, when he was arrested in Milan. His phone had been taken from him, so he didn't have a phone, which might be why he took her two phones.
Yeah, and I would certainly be more inclined to think sort of the duvet was just about distancing and hiding. And then when we think about the next sort of steps of his behaviour, I mean, taking the phones is an interesting thing. But I think why they are discarded is because when he thinks about it, of course, they are the things that can be traceable. Mm-hmm. And that, again, would point to sort of criminal sophistication just on the burglary side.
Right, burglary, right.
Right. But of course, he didn't have his phone. But it might have been those things that he just quickly grabbed rather than thought through at the time. But then he discards.
Were his fingerprints ever recovered from those phones? Do we know?
I doubt it. But what might have happened was he might have gotten to a certain point and realized how stupid it was because they can be tracked, or he might have found that they were password protected and he couldn't use them at all, so he just tossed them.
Well, one was a sort of a cheap, you know, pay as you go, and the other one was hers. But I'd more than likely be inclined to think that it's more about the traceable element for him, because then thinking of next steps, you know, post offence behaviour, the fact he's cleaned himself up to a degree. But I think what's interesting is the fact that he appears in a club dancing, and that's the sort of thing that I would expect from the perpetrator in this particular case, that evolved from one thing to something else, but now is thinking about getting himself alibied and other people seeing him, and then this kind of transition into, you know, creating some distance between him and the crime scene. And I think so, you know, those next steps of disappearing himself to Germany, which again he talks about in his interview, but says, oh, of course it could have been Russia, I was just a poor 20-year-old boy. But that's quite a distance to put between yourself and something that's gone on, and of course not call for help.
Well, let's talk about that behaviorally. What would you expect somebody who planned on a burglary, ended up doing a sexual assault and committing a murder, and then finishing the burglary? What would you expect post-defense behavior to be in that kind of a case?
Well, I mean, I would say the things that did then unfold. And, you know, the cleanup was you know, not particularly sophisticated in terms of himself, but him going somewhere else, you know, cleaning up properly and then getting himself out somewhere that's visible so that people can say, well, I saw X, Y, and Z, you know, at this time and time, date, stamp it.
He might have been there initially, too. He might have established himself somewhere at the beginning of the night.
I mean, possibly. He could have just been, you know, wandering around, you know, at the start of the night, and he could well have gone off and got this kebab, and all those things being true.
Sure.
And, you know, I would expect that to be the case. But then when he appears in a club thereafter, people would think that's a very odd thing, if he did commit this crime, for him to do. But actually, I would certainly expect it and see it more as more than likely, because now he's thinking through those sort of next steps, and maybe, as you know, he becomes a little bit more cognizant of the reality of what's happened, you know, thinking about then putting some distance between him, you know, and what has happened. So a geographical distance. And of course, you know, we know that, you know, there are offenders who do that, and they would distance themselves even in terms of language, as we know, in terms of when they even talk about the crime, put distance between who the victim is and what happened and them.
Right, and in this case, I think it's very instructive to know that not only did he leave the town, he left the country. And he says that was because he was afraid, he was panicked and so forth, that he would get blamed for this crime. But the fact is that, A, he didn't help her. He didn't try to save her life. He didn't call out for help. And then, B...
Well, he says that he did try and, you know, staunch the and stem the bleeding. But the point is he never called out.
No.
He never called for anybody and, you know, shouting out or using one of the phones to call the emergency services.
He didn't do anything that way. But then he also went out. This is a person who says he was so traumatized by the scene that he just fled in fear. And yet he went out. He went out to a club.
And he was seen dancing.
Yes. That sounds to me like a very different kind of individual.
It's highly incongruent.
Being painted. Yeah, definitely.
When we come back, we'll finish up on the crime scene.
It turns out Gaudet's handprint, made in Meredith Kircher's own blood, was found in the victim's room. Gaudet's DNA found inside the victim's body, in her vagina. His DNA on her clothing, on her purse, his feces even found on used toilet paper left near an unflushed toilet down the hall.
So let's return to the crime scene and just the behaviour and the sequence of events, because I think there's still quite a bit that we just need to talk about, Jim. I mean, in particular, sort of the sequencing of, you know, does he realise that there's no way out, and therefore he then goes into Meredith's room looking for her, and maybe she's undressed, she's getting changed.
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable reading of the facts. There's probably he was searching to get the keys so he could get out the front door. He's not going to jump out the second story window that he came in through, but he needs to get out of the house. So he probably went back to look for her.
And so you're thinking maybe he maybe threatened her, give me the keys, or could have made up a story. I don't know.
Well, he may have intended to do that, but she may have been in the process of getting undressed. It's at night. She's alone in the house.
She's come back early. We know that she's tired because she'd been out the night before. So it's highly likely she's come back for an early night. So she would be in her room getting undressed.
Right. And that could account for the fact that there's none of his DNA was found on those pieces of clothing. But there was his DNA found on the left side of her bra.
Right.
And so we know she had that on because some of the aspirated blood that sprayed onto the bra was done so in proximity to her mouth. So it was still on her at the time. But so he probably went into the room to try to see if he could get the keys. And he found her in a state of, you know, half undress. And that aroused him, got him excited. And he decided he wanted to have sex with her. And of course, she fought him. He tried to control her, most likely from behind, based on the two parallel scratches from the knife on her neck and then the gaping wound in relatively the same position on the neck. And that those two scratches are cuts, but they're superficial cuts, look like control wounds. In other words, somebody who's holding a knife against somebody's neck, threatening to cut her if she doesn't comply. She continues to fight him, and then he slashes the knife across the neck.
And that's her non-compliance. That's where she's absolutely not going to be forced to do something that she doesn't want. But equally for him, it's a dynamic and unfolding situation. The opportunity is there, and maybe he just gets aroused.
Right. He thought she would comply, and yet she didn't. So he expected it to go his way. It didn't go his way. And so it just started deteriorating at that point.
It spirals out of control, and he has to try and regain the control because, of course, he may even be behind her, but we know that she has seen him on a number of occasions. So then it can transition into, you know, it's an evolving and dynamic situation into something else. And that's why what it might start out as a burglary, he goes into that address, and he obviously feels comfortable in being in other people's addresses.
Yeah.
And we will talk about, I keep saying, about his account, because there are some interesting things that, you know, sometimes burglars do get excited, or they've eaten something that's disagreed with them, and they do use the facilities thinking that no one will be back. And then when you are caught, you have to take some decisions, and it dynamically unfolds. And then it can become something sexual with non-compliance. Sadly, in this case, it turned into a homicide. So it is a very dynamic situation. That's people do try and look at these things in the cold light of day and clinically assess behavior and put things in boxes. And I think that's where, you know, you can become very myopic, because behavior and decision making is messy, and it is very organic and pertains to that particular set of circumstances and that situation and the offender's decision making and coping skills and ability to regain control. And this was his way of regaining control. And of course, things then unfold from there too.
I just wanted to read you something from our listener, Megan. She's commenting actually on our previous episode. Great episode. Listening to the part about how Meredith couldn't possibly be overpowered by one person reminded me of another famous Italian court opinion, the Denham defense, saying a woman in jeans must have consented because the rapist couldn't possibly get them off without her help, which was later clarified by the judge that a lack of defense wounds means she consented because no woman would passively allow that. It was another case where opinion was taken as fact. It's very
frustrating. I would like to ask how that woman was killed. Was she killed with a knife? Was she killed by strangulation?
But even a threat of doing something to your children or harming somebody else can get compliance, coercive control, you know, any of those things. And that's a complete false fallacy.
Yeah, it's just ignorance on the part of that judge and that prosecutor. I mean, clearly, the fact is that people are put in control by one person many times because they're afraid of being hurt and afraid of being killed.
Right.
I mean, somebody has already invaded your space. Somebody surprised you and blitzed you. I mean, it's a very difficult situation for a young lady to be in. And then to find, I mean, she could have been in a state of half-dress at that time, feeling very vulnerable. I mean, it's just outrageous.
And it's completely outdated. And, you know, all these kind of myths and stereotypes really, you know, need to be quashed and smashed through, and people need serious education because, you know, we think about domestic violence. All of that is built around coercion and power and control. And, you know, that old adage, well, there's no physical evidence of rape, ergo it's not rape, you know, is an absolute nonsense. And, you know, I sadly have seen many cases where one perpetrator has overpowered another using a knife or another weapon. And some of them are not conventional weapons either. You know, one victim in particular, Jane Clough, suffered 72 stab wounds at the hands of a perpetrator that she knew. She defended her life and fought for her life, and then he slit her throat to silence her forever. And these cases do happen. And of course, if people don't, you know, casework, or they don't have exposure to this, is all they tend to understand or see is shows like CSI and other sorts of, you know, TV shows, which you know, go some way to educating. But of course, in these kinds of shows, everything happens in a very clinical and quick and efficient way because they need to solve it in, you know, 45 minutes.
Exactly. Yep. Okay, guys, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about something else.
John Kircher's book includes his desperate attempts to reach his daughter once news spread in the British media that a female British student has been found murdered in Perugia. I called Meredith. The phone rings on, and still there is no answer. Eventually, a reporter calls John Kircher. I shall never forget her words. The name going around Italy, she says, is Meredith.
So far this episode, we've talked about multiple MOs. We've talked about the multiple attacker theory, staging, and the sexual aspect of it. What are we going to talk about to wrap up this ep?
The collection methods, although they might look like they're doing the right thing. I mean, they have the suits on and the booties and the gloves and the face masks and the hair covering. But the fact is that they were not collecting it properly. They had walked all over what they later determined was bloody footprints in the victim's blood, leaving Meredith's room with shoes that match Rudy Guede's shoes. And they
these
had,
were the Nike shoes.
Yes, Nike shoes.
Nike Outreach, I think.
Right. And not only did Amanda and Raffaele and two of their other friends walk all over it, but at least three or four police officers walked all over it before the crime scene people came. And then all the crime scene people walked all over it.
And Magnini, we saw all of them on camera walking through.
Walking all over actual crime scene evidence. The victim's blood in the hallway. They couldn't see it. They later determined that it was there because of luminol, even though some people think that's not the case. But the fact is that they did luminol the area and were able to determine in detail what the footprints looked like. But the fact is that they did not collect this evidence properly. A perfect example of that is that 46 days later, they had to go back and retrieve the victim's clothing, bra clasp, her purse. They determined that when they moved a pair of her boots from where they had been right next to her body to when they kicked it under the bed where they stuffed all the other clothing and all the footwear and so forth, that blood dripped down from those boots onto the floor. And then they said, oh, that was somebody staging the crime scene. No, it was you corrupting the crime scene that was there, and you're supposed to be a crime scene investigator. So they did a horrible job. But that was on the CSI side. What about on the actual investigative side?
Well, I was going to say that, you know, when you do look at that video, it does look like they do know what they're doing. And until you see, you know, and you said that at the start, until you see little things as well, like one of the CSIs had all her hair out, which, of course, you know, was wearing like a hood, but then her hair was all, you know, hanging came down up. The side of her chin. And, you know, we talked before just about the lack of using sterile tweezers when they were handling things.
Yeah, they didn't use any tweezers.
Right, they were using their hands and just passing it between, well, but kicking down doors. I mean, and it wasn't, I saw a couple of times, you know, where a door was just being kicked down. It wasn't Meredith's door. But, you know, we talked about handling multiple pieces of evidence.
Right, not changing your gloves, not changing the booties that you're wearing over your shoes when you go from room to room to room. Walking over one bloody crime scene into another bloody crime scene with the same booties on your shoes. I mean, it's just absolutely ridiculous.
Right, and that chain of command, I mean, that chain of custody, I don't know how you feel, Jim C., about, you know, obviously each piece of evidence has to be assessed and collected on its own merit. And, you know, some of the people that are tweeting Real Crime Profile are also sort of saying things like, well, if the crime scene was compromised in terms of the way that things were collected, then does that not just mean everything is thrown
it's a good
into
theory.
Question?
It's a good theory, but the fact is that they cannot contaminate one of Rudy Yere's fingerprints in blood onto the pillow under the victim. That can't be contamination. So that in and of itself disproves that theory that they came up with. The fact is Rudy left his fingerprints, which you cannot transfer a fingerprint because you have the same pair of dirty gloves on or the same booties on. You can't transfer somebody's fingerprint, especially not in the victim's blood, if it didn't exist already in the victim's blood right there. So there's plenty of copious amounts. We're not talking about transfer DNA of Rudy Gede. They didn't have to look for transfer DNA of Rudy Gede because they found plenty of actual hands-on fingerprints in the victim's blood in that crime scene, as well as DNA from him on her bra and as well as inside of the victim. They could not have contaminated his skin cells into the vagina of the victim. Not possible. So that theory, although I understand it, it does not hold any water at all.
And I think this is where the CSI effect plays in again. That, you know, people who read the books or watch the shows or, you know, think that they understand sort of the detail of forensics. But every piece of evidence is seen on its own merit and its own worth. And like you said, a full profile is very different from transfer or from cross-contamination. And of course, there were multiple collection points and large amounts of DNA and forensics that were found that belonged to Rudy Guede.
Right. And you can't make a footprint in the shape of his shoe in the victim's blood by contaminating it by somehow, unless you actually took his shoes from him, went into the crime scene, put the shoes on the blood, and then walked them out the door like his footprints were found to have walked. So it's just, you have to understand what the evidence is. You can't just broad brush the whole thing as if it's all the same. But the evidence that was collected that indicate Rudy Gede was in that room was very consistent with the fact that he not only was the sole offender, but that he had sexually assaulted and murdered Meredith Kircher.
And the shoe prints, I mean, it was, I believe, a Nike Outreach shoe. The same type, brand, and size was found in a box in a place that he was staying and recovered by the police. So, you know, again, looking at the context, how things are recovered and when, and, you know, and certainly matching them to something that is significant, which shoes that were found. But, of course, he gives an account about how all of these things got into being and being found in those places, and that's what we'll look at next. But yeah, I think it's important for us to note that Judge Hellman, in his determination, also said that the items regarding the forensics against Rudy Guede are numerous and unambiguous.
Yes.
They felt it was a very simple case around the forensics regarding him, and of course his account they did not believe. His version of events, and that's what we're turn our attention to next.
Yeah, we have so much more to talk about. I mean, you could talk about this case, and people have for years and years and years, but I really I'm so glad to be getting your perspective on it, and I can't wait to hear more.
Well, we will come back next week and continue talking about the murder of Meredith Kircher. And, of course, our heart goes out to her and her family and her friends. It is a very, very sad case, and even more so because of how her actual murderer is being treated right now. That's what we're going to talk about next week.
Yeah, and the way that he's being treated, it's been covered in the Italian media, but not much here, actually, was that he has been on unsupervised leave for 72 hours. And there were pictures found of him dining in a restaurant with a number of other people and having a great time. And also, you know, there was news about him and his lawyer going for a retrial. So as well as dining out and having this unsupervised leave from prison as a convicted murderer, he also has a retrial now listed for December the 20th.
And I'll post that picture on our Facebook page. But Laura, you told me something that shocked me about that picture, about who took it.
Yeah, I mean, if you look in the small print, you'll see that the person who took all the pictures of him in the restaurant was actually Nick Pisa, the journalist from the Daily Mail, who was obviously mentioned and not just mentioned. I mean, he was one of the talking heads in the Netflix show. But I think when we talk about Guede, we're going to spend quite a bit of time on him on the next podcast. So we'd invite our listeners to have a look at his very first interview that he gave on January the 22nd, 2016. It was actually an interview that he gave from prison with Franca Liosini. And it was part of one of the stories covered in Story Maledet, which means cursed stories. And it's a very extensive interview. There's actually 11 parts that you'll find online, and it's been translated with English subtitles.
Right, and one of our listeners actually posted that for me on our Facebook page, and I'll repost it in our feed. But yeah, from prison in air quotes, because it looks like he's in Sleeping Beauty's bedroom. It does not look like he's giving an interview from prison.
There's a couple of places where they pull back the camera and you're seeing an overview shot, and it's actually has a series of sewing machines. And
that's what I'm saying. It looks like a little fairyland where people are.
All right, well, it actually looks like a place where they're actually creating garments. I mean, it could be a job within the prison.
I mean, it's pre-taped. There's multi-cameras.
It looks like it's all lit like pinks and Disney pastels and silks and satins.
And it's highly stylized. Yeah. And, you know, Jim C and I have gone through it in detail, and we want to take you through what our thoughts are. And, you know, again, this is his very first interview post sort of the legal process. And I think even on its own, it's fascinating that a convicted murderer is being given airtime in this way.
Yeah, but you guys should watch it so that in advance of our next episode, so that you'll have a better understanding of what we're talking about. You can experience it yourself, and we'd like to hear from you what you think.
Yeah, and let us know your thoughts on it.
Right, and we will fill you in on what we see behaviorally in this very revealing interview.
The other interesting thing just with the interview is that he also set up a Facebook and Twitter account just before this interview aired. So have a look. Guede did. So this sounds like a stage strategy and plan. And obviously he is asked about the retrial in this interview. And now we've had it confirmed that the 20th of December. And ironically, it would be Meredith Kircher's 30th birthday on December the 28th.
Mm. Very sad.
Yes.
Well, that's it for this week on Real Crime Profile. Thank you for listening, and we'll be continuing with the case of the murder of Meredith Kircher next week on Real Crime Profile.
So if you enjoy our podcast and would like to support us, there are a couple of important things you can do. First, you can go over to iTunes and give us a positive 5-star review. You can check out our sponsors and take advantage of the special promotions for Real Crime Profile listeners. You can go over and like our Facebook page, and you can follow us on Twitter. But most importantly, you can share our podcast with friends, family, and anyone you know would be interested in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes. So thank you for listening.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter or counselling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214 946 4357 or go on their website www.genesisshelter.org or the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.
If you're a regular listener to the show, you know we have great brands like Blue Apron, Audible, and Casper advertising with us, and they keep coming back because our listeners really respond to them, which we're really thankful for. Well, if you happen to own a business or manage the advertising buy for one, then you should consider advertising on Real Crime Profile. Podcast advertising is on the rise, and it's one of the most effective ways of reaching consumers on the go today. So please go to Wondery.com/advertisers. Again, it's Wondery.com/advertisers. And get in touch with us. Thanks.